I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Alex, for quite the ride. That was fascinating. I can start, but if anyone has anything. Yeah.
Thank you for that amazing talk. I didn't know anything about this history, so I'm just bowled over. But also very curious, and this may be a really dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The exhibition at MoMA with the textiles, I mean, honestly, I was amazed by that and really fascinated. And also by the archive photograph of African-American women looking at those textiles. So I'm asking a question that may be not easy to answer because my interests tend to cross across diasporas. So I'm interested in what the impact of that exhibition was on the ongoing, long-standing sort of craft traditions amongst African-American women that predate that moment, but have no official recognition. So is there any kind of dialogue happening?
I'm really glad you've asked this question, and because I also love that image. And it's actually, it's from MoMA's site, and it's one of the only images from the show that actually show visitors in the show. They were clearly very into it too, in other words. There's a staged aspect to it. But the image was so interesting to me that I also kind of got obsessed with this question of like, what was the African-American reception, not only of that show, but more generally. There is a very interesting story to be told about African-Americans in India, especially in political terms, and in terms of Gandhi and ism and things like that. But answering your specific question, I was not able to track down any data on this, and I wish I could. It's such an interesting question. But just to spin it a tiny bit in a slightly different direction, it also relates to gender very much, because, in fact, MoMA was very specific about its attempts to attract women to the museum. This was a time of explosive growth in museum attendance. Museum attendance was being promoted on television very heavily as part of a modern lifestyle. There are many, many TV shows shot inside museums. Earlier, a couple weeks ago, I saw a 30-minute program that Omnibus, or I think it was Adventure, one of those two programs, did a whole show inside the Family of Man. You can go through, you will see the entire show, you'll see people interacting with the images. It's really amazing. And the TV networks were very aware of their audiences, mainly women. So MoMA, you can find all kinds of internal, this has actually been written about by a woman named Lynn Spiegler, you can find all kinds of internal documents from MoMA discussing audience demographics, and the show was obviously aimed at women, and a lot of MoMA's activities were aimed at women, which is an interesting thing to throw into the mix when you talk about MoMA's vision of internationalism, which seems very machoistic in a way. Actually, mid-century MoMA was kind of a marked women's space as well, and that show was a really good example of that.
Okay, so another question that might be hard to answer, but that was a fantastic answer, so thank you very much. My mind is kind of going a bit nutty right now, just making sense of all of this fantastic information. So one other question. The obvious sort of links between these sort of influences is Alice Coltrane.
Yes.
And so...
John Coltrane's very important in terms of the influence of Indian classical music on American popular music. A lot of people came to Indian classical music through jazz, and most specifically through people like Yusuf Lateef, but even more specifically through Coltrane, because Coltrane was already in the early 60s, like listening very seriously to Indian music, incorporating Indian music into his work, and talking about it. And so he was such a cult-like figure, especially among white avant-gardists, that he gave them a kind of gateway drug to India. So Coltrane's influence is super important to that story, yeah.
So does he know Ravi Shankar? Are they connected?
Yes. Ravi Shankar was introduced to John Coltrane by the head of World Pacific Jazz Records, which released most of Ravi's records, a LA-based record label. There was a sort of beatnik guy who ran it named Richard Bach, who was also into... He was like into Indian spirituality and stuff, and Coltrane managed to engineer an introduction to Shankar through him. And according to Ravi Shankar, Coltrane had plans to come out to study at his music school in LA, which he ran in the 60s, but died like a couple months before he was able to come and make the trip. So there was supposed to be more of that on the way.
So does Alice then draw on that legacy?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
It's also interesting what you've just said about MoMA's audience and how it was catering to women, because one of the things that I think also relates to Paz's presentation, this question of exhibition as medium in terms of kind of U.S. cultural policy. In the 30s, with the WPA, Works Progress Association program, the emphasis was very much on producing artists. Right, so projects in Harlem, etc., that were, you know, mural-based, that were somehow, directed towards involving people from more communities into artistic production. And then what changed, and MoMA was kind of at the forefront of this, is that the U.S. went from this kind of production of artists into production of viewers, right? And the focus really was bringing people.
Viewers and shoppers, I think it's really
exactly.
important. I
mean, because museum shop. Also.
Actually, this Absolutely. Show was not organized by the International Council and had Porter McRae actually had nothing to do with it, although he was quite an Indophile and served in India during World War II. The story of Porter McRae in India could fill a book. But it was organized by the Junior Council, which was otherwise known mainly for their holiday card sales and was very marked woman's space within the museum.
Right,
and
the museum
and
Reser
Clark, it was, as I said. So that's really important.
Questions? There you go.
Yeah, kind of another media studies question, which I think it, like everyone else, really a very interesting, fascinating talk. But to follow up a bit on this media studies question, it's a bit vague to me, but thinking about how in the 1960s, you know, the Vietnam War became known as the television war and had impact in the U.S. On the U.S. Civilian attitude towards war. Was there, how would you like characterize then this kind of emergent non-allied world, specifically India, in relation to this the media in which it was disseminated, in particular television, like keeping in mind Marshall McLuhan's idea of TV as a cold medium, like mm-hmm. To reformulate a bit, the media vis-a-vis its hotness or coldness, could you say something about how this affected like an American notion of the world outside the U.S. Mm. in the 1950s?
Like, at first when you were speaking, I was thinking about how I had recently tried to track down instances of Nehru appearing on American television in the late 1950s out of curiosity about this issue, and I was able to find a few examples of him addressing the United States. I was kind of thinking of Nehru as like more like a sex symbol for some reason at that moment too, because of course he's a really handsome, intelligent guy, and that was not lost on these housewives who made up the viewership of those television shows. And I was just sort of interested in when did like non-aligned Nehru become sexy on American TV? Is that the same question?
Yeah.
I don't know. I that's a funny answer to a serious question. The McLuhan hot cold dichotomy, I can't say I've thought about it a lot in terms of this particular question of India on TV and reshaping perception. I think that this was an experiment that didn't particularly work. In terms of like this ad for India, I think that by the late 50s you see a totally different India on American television. It's much more standard, and that relates to, frankly, the food aid policies that were, you know, the American food aid had started going to India in the late 50s, and there's a sort of much more repugnant image of India with a begging bowl that you see maybe more on that One Step Beyond show where I start, which is this sort of paranoid story about don't travel in India or whatever, you know, this sort of travel to India gone horribly wrong. And actually, if I could have gone into more detail, there's this whole craft design. There's also craft objects play an important role in this reincarnation paranoid thing from the riddle. So to me, that the riddle sort of gets us back to the kind of India as this overpopulation. I mean, population control is a major part of U.S.-India policy from the 50s onwards, and it's a totally shameful history that we've yet to reckon with. But I think I'm just avoiding the McLuhan question. I'm sorry.
I mean, if someone else doesn't have a question, a kind of completely unrelated follow-up question, which would have to do with the dissemination of Eastern spirituality in the 50s and 60s through figures like Gerald Hurd and Alan Watts. Mm-hmm. And in your research, did you find any crossover between this kind of, because you really foreground the role of consumption in this narrative, but with regard to like alternative lifestyles or alternative philosophies, have you found any crossover in terms of the kind of influence, a holistic influence of like Eastern spirituality as advocated by these Western proponents.
Right, and with the sort of TV India, Museum of Modern Art idea, yeah, that of 55. You know, there's a very specific way to trace some of those influences, and one would be that Ustad Ali Akbar Khan LP, because it's very famously influenced Lamont Young, for instance. Lamont Young first heard that record at UCLA while he was an undergraduate there in ethnomusicology, then a brand new discipline which had essentially been introduced to the United States at UCLA by a European-trained musicologist named Mantel Hood, who was a specialist in Javanese gamelan. He brought the first gamelan to the United States, and now almost every university in the United States has gamelan orchestra. He was the one who managed to include an Asian quote-unquote classical music in the Western sort of musical teaching tradition at the university level for the first time. So he's a really important character too. But Lamont was studying ethnomusicology at UCLA as an undergraduate, mainly for access to their amazing record collection. And among that was the first Indian record he heard. And more importantly, it was the first drone he heard that wasn't generated by the wind or by, you know, like by cracks in the house and things like that, which had also influenced him as a child. So the sound of the tambura drone on this record that was recorded at MoMA was extraordinarily influential to his idea about minimalism and music, and that idea had a lot of impact, both at an aesthetic and sort of tying in with the whole emergence of countercultural India of the 60s. And that also gets into the Coltrane question as well, very much. I mean, because of the way that India was packaged and sold to the American public as a quintessentially spiritual culture, it was kind of baked into it from the start, in a sense. I mean, already you have Stella Kramrisch trying to link everything to the Vedas. I mean, even just these fabrics for sale, and obviously even these dance forms, which were in fact the legacies of Muslim performing families going back. You know, centuries, who had been basically stigmatized and driven out of their own musics and dance. So it's a really twisted history. It's difficult to reduce these complexities into a 45-minute talk, but yeah, it's a great question. And yes, it was very tied into the sort of introduction of Indian spirituality, or whatever you want to call it, to white Americans. And black Americans too, I think. Harder question.
How would you relate that to the John Cage, Geeta Sarabhai relationship?
That, you know, that I think happened in the 40s when she was in New York studying Western music, and they were introduced through Noguchi, who was a close friend of the Sarabhais and many other people, talk about another catalytic figure who played an important role in terms of international cultural exchange during that time. Noguchi was one, and so was his sister, actually, Ilspinden. I assume that people with that, I mean, I think by 55, John Cage had moved into his Zen Buddhist phase through D.T. Suzuki and others. But in the 40s, he did go through this very, before he discovered Zen Buddhism, he sort of discovered A.K. Kumaraswamy, another catalytic sort of cultural exchange figure, who's also connected with Stella Kramrisch. I mean, it was such a small world that, yeah, the Sarabhais lent many of the so-called masterpiece textiles for the show as well. So, yeah, the Sarabhais were plugged into the show. And, yeah, I don't know. I've never seen anything about John Cage actually going to it, or I've never heard him reference it. And he wasn't actually that interested in Indian music. He was much more entranced by Kumaraswamy's misrepresentations of it.
Any more questions? Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Very much.